WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, Jon Stewart stepped down from his anchor chair and his current role in the American conversation. Not a lot of comics get to such a place. Comparisons with Mark Twain are not entirely ridiculous. And to think that when he started on The Daily Show in 1999, he was a little-known comedian, actor, and talk show host. In the more than 16 years since then, 4 days a week, he has taken on politicians, network news, social injustice, and much more, playing fake newsman better than some real ones, and bringing intelligence and sometimes indignation along with the laughs. This hour, On Point, a farewell to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. You can join us on air or online. What's your favorite Daily Show memory, and what stands out to you about Jon Stewart's time there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Renee Graham. She is music and pop culture critic and op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe. Renee Graham, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John.
And from Syracuse, New York, Robert Thompson is with us. He is director of Syracuse University Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Communication. Bob Thompson, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Lisa Rojak is with us. She is author of Angry Optimist, The Life and Times of Jon Stewart. Lisa Rojak, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the ending. Last night, Jon Stewart signed off The Daily Show for his final time.
Nothing ends. It's just a continuation. It's a pause in the conversation. So rather than saying goodbye or goodnight, I'm just going to say, I'm going to go get a drink. And I'm sure I'll see you guys before I leave. So that's our show. I thank you so much for the privilege of being able to perform it for you, for the privilege of being able to do it. And so here it is. My moment is in.
And at that point, Bruce Springsteen came out on stage and serenaded Jon Stewart off into the sunset or into maybe perhaps chapter two or chapter three. There have been a lot of chapters. But Renee Graham, I want to go to you and ask whether you think that he is getting a little bit of this national treasure treatment. Do you think it's appropriate, and do you think it makes him uncomfortable?
I think it makes him uncomfortable to a point, but at the same time, it felt like he was fully embracing it. You know, I thought the last show was very self-congratulatory. And it's like at a certain point you felt like, yes, John, we get it. You are awesome. You know, but he really was an important part of the conversation for the last 15 years. And I'm sure in a way that he never anticipated that he would be. You know, it was must-see TV, but also very much buoyed by the fact that you could watch the clips the next day and you could watch the show the next day online. So I think that made a big difference, and I think it really changed the way people looked at politics and media. So, yeah, his role is important. National treasure, I'm not going to say that.
Enough
but
already,
very important.
Huh?
Exactly, very important.
Do you think he was surprised by how it all turned out?
I think he was. I mean, I think you have to remember kind of who he was in 1999. You know, the year before he took over The Daily Show from Craig Kilborn, he was an actor and he was, you know, doing little movies and movies that weren't doing well. And in particular, this one movie called Playing by Heart, which was kind of like this, you know, Robert Altman movie for dummies sort of thing. You know, lots of characters and interwoven stories. And I always look back and think if that movie in 1998 had been a success, he probably never would have gone to The Daily Show. So when he got the show, no one really knew who he was. He hadn't had that kind of success. So, yeah, I don't think he possibly could have imagined in 1999, you know, where he would be 16 years later.
As you say, Playing by Heart was not an incredibly successful movie. Probably most of our listeners haven't heard of it. It was 1998, and he played somebody called Trent, and he was the love interest to Gillian Anderson. And for those who have never heard of it, hear it now.
I have to tell you something.
Oh, this doesn't begin with Trent, you're a nice guy, does it?
No. The problem I have with you.
We have problems.
The problem I have with you is that I'm attracted to you.
And that's a problem.
Lisa Rojak, you're the author of Angry Optimist, The Life and Times of Jon Stewart, came out last year. Do you agree with Renee Graham that acting thing, if it had worked for Jon Stewart, we would never really have heard of him at this point?
Possibly, but I think that Stewart was really, his heart has always been in stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. And the various movie roles he played back then, he was kind of dabbling. He was, in a way, killing time until the next big thing came along. I mean, before that, he was he did his MTV show for 2 years, and he was crowned the voice of the slacker generation. And he had also been turned down for a couple of different other talk shows. He was in the running to take over Letterman's show for a while when Letterman thought he was leaving. So when he first started on The Daily Show, he was taking over from Craig Kilborn, and whose approach to the show was basically to do as much frat boy comedy as possible. And so he took over, and he treaded lightly for the first year or two, but then he put his unique stamp on the show, and little by little, and then the 2000 election hit, and the presidential campaign season got into full swing, and I think that's when he really found he found his calling, basically, at that point.
Bob Thompson, as Lisa was just saying, he found his calling at that point. A lot of people have said that his calling, he's always called himself fake newsman, but a lot of people see his calling actually to be an informer. And it's always been said that there are people who literally get their news from The Daily Show. Do you buy that people actually get their news there, or are they savvy enough to know they're getting something very filtered?
Right. You know, I'm still a little choked up from that movie clip you just made. Yes. I mean, when we first started hearing those surveys that young people are getting their news from Jon Stewart, I think most of it was outrage. What's happening to this generation? Now, after all these many years, when you hear that young people are getting their news from The Daily Show, I could think of a lot worse places to get news. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you don't want to have the only thing you know about the world to come from a comedy show, but to have that as part of your information portfolio, it's a pretty solid part. And that's what I think The Daily Show did that had not been going on a regular basis in American comedy. Johnny Carson told jokes about politics, but he really was not terribly politically insightful. Chevy Chase pretended to be Gerald Ford and stumbled over a podium, but we got no insights on the Ford administration. And even Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live was set up, punchline. What Jon Stewart started doing, and I agree, it really started hitting on all cylinders during that fiasco of the 2000 election. What he started doing was a form of investigative comedy, where they did the research, they got the clips, they put the clips together and showed the contradictions. The Daily Show did, in a comic mode, the kind of thing that I think we would like to see real journalists do in a serious reportorial mode. And sometimes, when it came to, for example, the lead-up to the war after September 11th, some of that story was being prosecuted better on The Daily Show than it was being prosecuted over on the 24-hour cable channels.
Well, as you say, that a lot of people pinpoint to December of 2000 as when the election was contested as the real turning point, the real grow-up moment for The Daily Show. Here's Stewart on December 13th that year announcing the winner of the 2000 presidential campaign.
Welcome to a very special live edition of The Daily Show. It is now official. We can call it at 855 hours and 2 minutes of this election night, the state of Florida and its 25 electoral votes, with 100% of its precincts reporting, will go to George W. Bush. And the crowd loves it.
Let's bring in Walter, calling from Springfield, Mass. Walter, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I must tell you first that we in this household are in our 60s, so we kind of skew the demographics a bit. But we watched his departure last night. We watched John's departure and felt completely bereft, as if we had lost a trusted family advisor. You know, when you're a grown-up and you don't engage in partisan tantrums and you look carefully at what's going on and you're not naive, there are precious few voices to back that up. And John's was one of those voices with human dignity and compassion as well as the humor. We're going to miss him greatly, and I'm afraid we'll all run mad not having him around to keep us all on track.
All right. Thanks for your call, Walter. Let's bring in Camille from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Camille. You're on Point.
Hi, Mr. Donovan.
Hi.
Thank you to you, and thank you to John Stewart. He brought comedy that had no sarcasm, which was not snide, which played to the better natures of all of us. It was healing to the nation and elevated our conversation. And personally, that I was recovering from a TBI and the fifth show of the week meant that I started recognizing that I'd heard that earlier in the week. He touched my life in a way that I know he touched everyone's lives in many ways, so thank you.
Camille, thanks very much for your call. And let's bring in quickly Sean from New Haven, Connecticut. Sean, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess I'm sad to see him and Stephen Colbert end their runs at a similar time or within the same, you know, 6 months to a year. Some of the things that I think of looking back at, you know, watching them, I'm not sure what I'm going to do between, you know, 11 o'clock and midnight now. But I remember going to their rally in D.C. where one side called it, one side was like Restore Insanity, and the straight man John was, I can't remember what his might have been, Restore Sanity, and Colbert's was Instill Fear.
Well, Sean, thanks for your call. I'm so sorry to break into you only because we're coming up to a break, but thanks for calling in to us. Bob Thompson, Renee Graham, and Lisa Rojak, please stand by. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking this hour about Jon Stewart's departure from The Daily Show. We're talking with Renee Graham. She's music and pop culture critic and op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe. Bob Thompson, director of Syracuse University's Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Communication. And Lisa Rojak, who is author of Angry Optimist, The Life and Times of Jon Stewart. And we've already sort of referred to the sense that he had an arc to his career, that we watched him evolve from 1999 on when he was in that seat. I want to go back to before that period and listen to a little bit of, first of the kinds of humor he was doing when he was doing stand-up. As Lisa Rojak, as you mentioned, he sees himself as a stand-up comic probably before everything else. So this is back in 92 at the Just for Laughs Festival.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. Man, I was watching the Olympics all day today, and I am really glad they're almost over. If I have to sit through one more tragic profile of a courageous athlete. Can't anybody get to the Olympics without some sort of catastrophe along the way?
And Lisa Rojak, where is the not Jon Stewart that we know today present there? That's a very confusing question. I'm going to have to rephrase to you to make notes, but I think you get what I'm getting at.
Sure.
Are the seeds of the man we know today in that stand-up act back then?
In a way, yes, in terms of his tone and approach. I mean, he basically started his stand-up career making fun of himself and his background. I mean, he focused on his Jewish heritage when he first started doing stand-up. And, you know, in the comedy clubs of New York City at 2 in the morning when you're basically entertaining drunks, it doesn't go over very well. But it's what he had to do to establish. He had to kowtow to the accepted line of comedy that people go to see stand-up comics for. So the atmosphere of a late-night club where everybody's drunk is a lot different from being on your own soapbox and having your own show.
So I want to jump forward 5 years to 1997 when he was invited to be the entertainment at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I actually, I was at that dinner at that time. As it happens, I was the White House correspondent for ABC, and I had a little bit of an insight to that booking. The president of the White House Correspondents' Association who finalized the booking was the Associated Press reporter named Terry Hunt, who told me that he was getting a lot of grief from his fellow White House correspondents because he had booked somebody that they'd never heard of. He said people were saying, who is this Stewart guy? And he said he was also a little nervous because Stewart was calling him, asking what was going on in Washington to sort of get some material. And then it's interesting to hear what Jon Stewart actually put on the stage that night, because it he was reflecting the fact that nobody really knew who he was at that point.
Rosie O'Donnell was the president's first choice to be here this evening, and she withdrew, citing a nasty and brutal confirmation process. I wasn't even the second choice. Dennis Miller was the second choice, but he got hung out by an illegal nanny technicality. But isn't that what the confirmation process is all about here in Washington? Weeding out the truly qualified to get to the truly available.
So, Renee Graham, 2 years later, he starts The Daily Show and begins this evolution that we've been talking about. And I think a key part of that evolution, the reason he's resonated so much, is that it wasn't always funny. It wasn't always about the jokes.
I think that was an important thing that people started to turn to Jon Stewart for. And, you know, by the time we got to the Charleston Church Massacre in June, and he made that incredibly eloquent monologue, you know, and he admitted he had no jokes. There was nothing funny to be derived from that. And what he reminded me of in that moment was Walter Cronkite. And when people talk about Walter Cronkite, the great CBS newsman, they always reference three moments. The way he choked up when he had to announce that President Kennedy had been killed, when Apollo 11 lands on the moon and he's sort of teary but in a very happy way, and also the commentary he made about Vietnam being an unwinnable war. And I think what stood out about those moments is that it was the humanity of those moments. It was sort of stripping away this idea of objectivity and really getting to the heart of what everybody was feeling. And Jon Stewart managed to do that time and time again, much more so in recent years than in some of the earlier years. But there was always this sense of indignation in what he was doing, that he was skewering the absurdity of it all. And he never sort of lost, even when he was being funny, he never lost track of the fact that, you know, the stakes were very high in the things he was talking about, and the consequences were dire. And I think that he really, really developed his voice to talk about serious subjects, to literally sort of, you know, quote unquote, take the funny out of it and just get to the heart of it. And I think that really connected with viewers in the way that they really weren't getting anywhere else.
Did he let his own politics show?
I think in some cases. You know, I think, you know, early on he was sort of, you know, dodgy about his politics. And I think as time went on, I don't think he really cared. I think it wasn't about, you know, being red state or blue state or being Democrat or Republican. The point was to be honest about what was going on, to call it as he sees it. And, you know, when people talk about Donald Trump and they say, oh, they like Donald Trump because he says what's on his mind, that's what Jon Stewart did. And he had the flexibility to do that. And so, you know, when you had the Charleston situation and you had people sort of flapping about and saying, oh, was this terrorism or not, he could just say that. And everyone can just nod and go, thank you. You know, stop pretending it's not the thing we know it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't, you know, he never punched down. The idea was he expected his audience to be as intelligent as he was, and he talked to them like adults.
Did the fact that he was a comic and not a journalist or a politician, is that what gave him the room to do
that?
Oh,
it gave him all kinds of flexibility. I mean, you know, look, I don't think anyone wants to watch the network news shows in the evening and have, you know, anchors who are making jokes and that kind of thing. That's not really their purpose. And, you know, he was always very upfront about the fact that he wasn't a journalist, but he understood journalism and the power it had and the way that it could work. And I think that's how he used it. Yes, he could, you know, sort of play the, oh, this is fake news and I'm a comedian, but it also gave him a lot of leeway that other journalists just don't have.
That's how he tended to talk about it. In an interview with Fox News' Chris Wallace, back in 2011, he defended his role as a comedian and not as a political player on The Daily Show.
I'm not an activist. I'm a comedian.
All right.
And my comedy is informed by ideology. There's no question about that. But I'm not an ideologue.
Bob Thompson, was he or was he not an ideologue?
Usually not, and I think here's where the Cronkite connection comes in again. Generally, Walter Cronkite was delivering the news, he was doing it old school style, and every now and again he came out and actually advocated something. And of course, the editorial he did about how we needed to get out of Vietnam was that key moment. John Stewart would occasionally do that. The bit he did on the first responders bill, I think, was a sense where that was a real Cronkite moment, even an Edward R. Murrow moment. And by the way, when I compared him to Cronkite and Murrow as recently as 2010 once, I got a lot of flack that how dare you mention a comedian with those people. Now everybody is doing that. So some of this stuff is relatively more recently that he's become canonized. But no, usually he was doing what he just said. He was plowing through this stuff and doing comedy. But occasionally he'd find a subject, and you knew when Jon Stewart was going into his sincerity hyperdrive, and then he could become a very powerful advocate of certain issues.
Do you remember the time he appeared on CNN's Crossfire program back in 2004?
Oh, yes.
So let me play a little bit of that, and then we'll talk about it.
You're doing theater when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
You do it's
not
true.
Honest. What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And I'll tell you,
Kerry on your show, and you sniff his throne, and you're accusing us of partisan hackery?
Absolutely.
You've got to be kidding me.
You're on CNN.
You literally say,
the show that leads into me is puppets making crank phone calls. What is wrong with you?
That was Stewart spontaneously debating with the show's then co-host Tucker Carlson, and it was not shortly after that CNN canceled that show. And actually, the president of CNN at that time cited that critique by Jon Stewart as his very much influencing his thinking that the show needed to go. And what really was his point, Bob Thompson?
Well, I think he was what he does on his show. Let's face it, Jon Stewart is a political satirist, but the most important part of The Daily Show under his regime was as a burlesque of how the media, how television news covers all of these sorts of things. So the things that he usually made fun of and satired and parodied on the show, he now actually was on the show itself and was able to address one of the subjects of his burlesque. And it's interesting, that Crossfire thing happened pretty early. That was one of the first to reach the pantheon of what we would call viral videos. And that's been true of a lot of the Daily Show. The influence of this program is so disproportionate to its actual audience that watches it at 11 o'clock Monday through Thursdays. And that's because it does. The things he does on that show get talked about on 24-hour cable. Influence, I guess, the cancellation of Crossfire gets sliced and diced and passed around on the Internet. That Crossfire moment was another big key point in the Jon Stewart story, and of course it didn't even happen on The Daily Show.
And here's another big moment. This was a few years before that, on September 20th, 2001. The Daily Show went back on the air after September 11th, and Stewart gave an emotional response to the attacks in his opening monologue.
Any fool can blow something up. Any fool can destroy. But to see these guys, these firefighters, these policemen, and people from all over the country, literally with buckets, rebuilding, that's extraordinary. And that's why we've already won.
And Lisa Rojak, Jon Stewart went on a lot to stand up for those firefighters and policemen. Tell us about that.
Well, he's always wanted to stand up for the underdog, you know, and so he never stopped during the whole reign of his show. And, you know, he started out by wanting to skewer the media, basically, when he first went on the air, and also to change things. And when I think the Crossfire show was an exercise in frustration for him, obviously, but it was also a clear sign that he was getting frustrated that he himself, through the influence of his show, was not able to change either the media or politics. In fact, they were getting worse under his watch. And so I think that he just decided to focus his efforts in a very small way where he could definitely have see a change, and that is why he started to have the throw the spotlight more on the firefighters and the police forces and the military throughout the length of his entire show.
Let's check in with some of our listeners. Tom is calling from Sudbury, Mass. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
A couple of brief points, please. I'm well up into my 60s, and I remember that previous generation of news reporters, of whom Cronkite was an example, who were willing to bring up the hard questions and the hard topics and ask the hard questions. But nowadays, mainstream media is censored by mostly commercial interests, and even NPR will often softball your interviews. What does that leave us with? That left us with Jon Stewart. And I'd like to briefly address the comedy question also, in that Jon Stewart, with his directness, brings us up a lot of topics which can easily engender anger. And I think a really constructive way of dealing with anger is humor. And that's about it, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. I think, Renee Graham, that he actually got to the point that the humor gave him this safe place to do a lot of what he did.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, he kept saying he wasn't a journalist because he wasn't a journalist. I don't think he had any interest in being a journalist. But being a comedian and being funny gave him so much more leeway to do what he wanted to do. And sometimes that was, sometimes it was very slapstick, sometimes it was scatological. But the point was always to kind of send up the things that were happening in the country. But when he needed to be serious, he could do that as well, and he could do it in a far more pointed way than a journalist could ever do.
Let's bring in Met from Nashville. Hi, Met. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My comment was that throughout the whole talk we've had, you've been having this past hour, there's been a lack of input by people from my generation. I'm a 22-year-old young American who just recently got pretty involved in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to give my perspective on how John has affected us, my generation,
mm-hmm.
who, and my personal perspective, has been afflicted with this idea of a mentality of how politics is just two-sided and there's just one fight against the other, as if there's just two opinions.
So how did John Stewart affect you in that way?
And we've been very inactive in my generation.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jon Stewart has provided us with is an idea of what journalism and what media is actually supposed to be doing, and what true journalism looks like. Of course, he has the underlying comedy, and his show is mostly comedic. But I feel like the comedy was, like you were just talking about, just a veil for him to be able to say the important issues and to be able to pull in the younger generation who's been disillusioned with politics. And for me personally, he was a very big part of me getting involved in politics and getting interested in politics, because in his lighthearted conversations, you could actually hear all the issues and see how they could affect you personally, and see that, hey, us not getting our voices heard is causing our country to change in a way majority of my generation doesn't like.
Okay, Matt, thank you very much for your call. And it's a very interesting point. I'm glad you brought it up, the way, Bob Thompson, the way that that he seems to have inspired some part of a generation to become more politically active, or at least more politically aware.
Right. I think there's no question about that. He delivered issues in a way that was impassioned. It was user-friendly. It was funny. Certainly my students, most of whom are between 19 and 27 years old, through most of the run of Jon Stewart, right up until today, very much point to him as an important part of their raising of their political consciousness. And, comedy's been doing that for a long time. When I was 12 years old and first started to engage with the fact that I was a citizen of a republic, my political consciousness was raised by Mad Magazine.
Bob, I've got to stop you there, but I know what you're talking about. Bob Thompson, Ray Graham, and Lisa Rojak. Stand by. We're coming back with all three of you. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about Jon Stewart, the comedian, the sarcastic fake news man, now gone from The Daily Show. We're talking with Renee Graham. She is music and pop culture critic and op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe. Bob Thompson, director of Syracuse University's Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Communication. And Lisa Rojak, she is author of Angry Optimist, The Life and Times of Jon Stewart. And we have been hearing from some of you via Twitter and on our website. Dave Diamond tweets, truly the end of an era, but my question is, will Trevor Noah be a suitable replacement? Trevor Noah, of course, was named soon after Jon Stewart's announcement that he would be the replacement, a comic from South Africa. TB tweets in, I find it mildly depressing that a supposedly well-informed NPR audience is so enamored with a partisan brat like Jon Stewart. And Figaran TM tweets, I think it was as biased as any other media outlet in the U.S. On our website, Scott B. writes in, he's sad that the national TV news has become entertainment, but glad that Jon made what was supposed to be entertainment into actual national news. Last night on the program, Stephen Colbert came on and he thanked Stewart for his time as the host of The Daily Show.
You are infuriatingly good at your job. Okay? Who were lucky enough to work with you, and you can edit this out later. All of us who were lucky enough to work with you for 16 years are better at our jobs because we got to watch you do yours, and we are better people for having known you.
Lisa Rojak, talk to us about the many people, not just Stephen Colbert, who got their starts and are major players now because of having had The Daily Show as a platform.
Oh, where do I start? You can pick a few.
We'll all take a few.
There's Lewis Black, who was the longest. He started during the Kilborn era, actually. He was the longest reigning employee or correspondent or pundit who appeared on The Daily Show. There's Colbert, of course, John Oliver, Samantha Bee. I mean, take it over.
And Bob Thompson, does that DNA carry forth? Steve Carell, others?
It does. And I'd like to point out, as everybody's kind of sorrowful that Jon Stewart is gone, the seeds that he planted, I mean, there was very little of this type of investigative comedy before he started doing it. There's a lot more of it now. I would argue that if you miss Jon Stewart, just stay up a half hour later and watch what Larry Wilmore is doing. That show is a definitely a work in progress, but I think he's become one of the most important voices in late night, a voice that we haven't heard very much. In some ways, I think he's on his way to out Jon Stewarting Jon Stewart. And John Oliver has got his own show, not every night, but he's even doing more long-form kinds of things. And I think it's possible that Trevor Noah could do something as exciting on The Daily Show in 2015 as Jon Stewart did in 2000. So Jon Stewart himself is no longer on the air, but he has left a legacy of some really solid programming. Forget just the stars that have gone on to be movie stars, people that are carrying on the same generic tradition that Stewart was so good at.
And I want to ask Renee Graham, the fact that Jon Stewart is leaving just actually the day after the first big Republican primary debate and launching the season leaves to Trevor Noah a lot of material to work with. Do you think he was trying to do Trevor Noah a favor?
You know, I don't think Jon Stewart had any idea that his last day would be the day of the big Republican debate.
Yeah.
And if he did, maybe he would have waited another week perhaps because there was so much material to mine from that debate. But, you know, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what direction Trevor Noah decides to take. He can't be Jon Stewart. I think he's going to set himself up to fail if he tries to do that. But I think that you know, people have to be patient. They have to let him find his voice the same way that Jon Stewart found his. Jon Stewart got lucky because he had the 2000 presidential election and the whole mess of that to deal with. Maybe Trevor Noah gets that moment and can kind of establish himself quickly. But, you know, I don't want to really see Trevor Noah do, you know, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, you know, in absentia. I just think he should do it his own way and figure it out.
But that's going to take some time.
That's going to take some time. And I think the audience, the same way I think that Larry Wilmore is now, after, 6 to 8 months, is sort of finding his sea legs now. Mm-hmm. I think Trevor Noah has to have the opportunity to sort out what he needs to be on that show.
The one sour note in all of this praise that's come down since Jon Stewart announced back last winter that he was going to be stepping down yesterday came in July when former Daily Show correspondent Wyatt Cenac appeared on Mark Maron's WTF podcast. And he told a story about having this confrontation with Jon Stewart while he was working on the show in 2011. Cenac, who is African-American, confronted Stewart about being made uncomfortable with an impression that Stewart had done on air of Herman Cain, the also African-American at that time Republican presidential candidate.
He got upset and he stood up and he was just like, off. I'm done with you. And he just started screaming at me. And he screamed it a few times.
And so that story of Wyatt Cenac, Lisa Rojack, it came out, it's been making the rounds mostly in online, not breaking out entirely in mainstream media. But what do we know about that? And where do things stand between the two of them now?
I'm not sure where the things stand between them at this point going forward, but based on the past, when somebody makes Jon Stewart angry, or when somebody has questioned the way that he's run the show, or as this example shows, he's presented a skit, or he's done something that somebody has been unhappy with, and then somebody has, that person has brought it up with him. He has no patience or tolerance for anybody questioning him. And so in my book, I researched a couple of instances where some of the correspondents questioned him in the same way, or about, you know, one little aspect of one segment, or a field report. And he does not like to be questioned at all.
Renee?
You know, when that story broke a few weeks ago, for me it was kind of like the Atticus Finch moment. You know, it was this chink in Jon Stewart's armor as this person who got it. And I think what was telling about that to me was this feeling that, you know, you can be well-meaning and quote-unquote get it, but it doesn't mean you can't learn something from someone else. And I think that's what Wyatt was trying to do. I don't think he was trying to rip Jon Stewart, but he was trying to say, as the only African-American on that staff, that this imitation that Jon Stewart was doing made him uncomfortable and seemed racially insensitive. And it was hard for me to hear, and I'm sure, you know, I speak for a lot of people, that Jon Stewart reacted the way he did, that he was so kind of in his own bubble and it began to drink his own Kool-Aid so much that he didn't quite understand what Wyatt was trying to say. Having said that,
point out, though, that Wyatt Cenac did appear last night on the final episode, and
yes.
Jon Stewart kind of had this sheepish look on his face and asked, "Are we good?" And then Wyatt kind of looked down and said, "Yeah, we're good." I mean, there was a kind of public kissing and making up that took place.
Somewhat.
On the final,
I mean, it was the only acknowledgement Jon Stewart made of this. I mean, and it did get a lot of traction. It was, you know, I think it broke in New York Magazine. The New York Times then went a much larger piece and interviewed other people who were in on that meeting, who all essentially said, "Yeah, that's what happened." You know, and I thought Jon Stewart would address it at some point, and he didn't.
Were you surprised that he didn't?
I was kind of surprised that he didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, he certainly addressed when it came out that he was having these meetings at the White House with President Obama and how Fox News was making a big deal about that. And he kind of just let this go. And I felt that the onus was then on Wyatt to help him make it right. So if Wyatt doesn't show up at the show last night, then everyone goes, "Wow, he's still upset and maybe Jon Stewart's kind of a jerk." But he doesn't do that. He goes there and he kind of blows Jon Stewart clean by showing up and letting him do this kind of like, you know, "We good, yeah, we good." You know, it was fine. You know, it was vague, and it was, if you knew what was going on, then it was great. But it was still an odd moment, especially coming up towards this great buildup to Jon Stewart's departure.
Interesting. Let's bring in Sarah from Milton, Massachusetts. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to comment, one on that comment that Donald Trump and John Stewart both speak their mind, because I thought that was a very odd comparison. But my real point was that this show brought my kids and me together in a way that no other show has, because it appealed to both of us. My son is 22. My youngest, it's interesting that you just had a 22-year-old on talking about how it made him more politically involved. But there was something for everyone. And we, even though you're not supposed to watch TV while you're having dinner, it was a really nice time to sit and talk. And they'd sort of fill me in on who he was tweaking, if it was an entertainer that I didn't know about. And I sort of filled them in on some of the political and historical references. And it's a real loss. And I feel like it's a part of our lives that, like the Harry Potter books, it's just, it's that significant. And so I'm very sad to see him go, as are my kids.
Thanks, Sarah, for your call. Lisa Rojak, there does seem to be this sense, especially as time passed, and he penetrated the culture more, that he did cross generations.
Yes, you know, when he first started his tenure at The Daily Show, the average viewership age was maybe in the mid-20s. And through the years, that average age has grown to, I think I saw something the other day that it was now 46 was the median age. But the interesting thing is the Jimmys, the Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon, their average age, viewership age, skews a lot higher in the mid-50s or so. So I think that the college students that who first started watching The Daily Show in 99, they have, you know, obviously grown up, but they've brought his increased visibility has also brought other generations in. And I love to hear that story about, you know, how it brings the generations, he's brought the generations together.
Bob Thompson, why do you think he's giving it up now?
I buy the story that his kids are getting to an age where he realizes they're not going to be around at home forever. I think it was a real grind to do that show, even though they took a lot of breaks and they were only 4 days a week. And he knows that he can have other opportunities. Though on his second to last day, he did an imitation of a Hamlet holding the skull of Yorick. And I hope Jon Stewart has also read King Lear, because my worry is that Jon Stewart is going to miss us even more than we miss him. And I think he may find, as he watches all this stuff that happens, that he really misses having a place to do what he does better than anybody else does.
Well, Renee Graham, how do we expect him professionally to fill his days now?
I can't even imagine what his morning is like. You know, and maybe it wouldn't have had the same effect because it's Friday. He wouldn't have been working today anyway. But you know, suddenly you're going to have Monday morning and he's not going to have this place to go to and he isn't going to have that outlet. And I think he's going to be disoriented for a little while, mm-hmm. you know, and there's going to be these conversations being had that he can't be part of. I don't see him being a big tweeter or being a person who's going to be on Twitter a lot. I don't see that kind of thing. But I think it's going to be very disorienting for a while.
Lisa Rojak, has he given clear indication of what he plans to do?
He might still be doing some stand-up here and there. He has announced that he's starting and he's founded an animal sanctuary in New Jersey, and because he's always been a big dog lover, and employees always were able to bring their dogs to the studio to work. He might, you know, his directing Rosewater, I believe, was the beginning of the end of his reign on The Daily Show, because he's obviously been, I look at him, he looks exhausted every night when I watch. And so I think he's going to take a nice long break, and the world is his oyster at this point, but I don't see him ever returning to the grind of doing a four-night-a-week show, mm-hmm. although he is going to still remain as an executive producer on The Daily Show. So that'll be interesting. He might, you know, just pop in and make little surprise appearances with Trevor Noah, and, you know, it'll be really interesting to see what he does in the next year or two after he gets a nice long break.
Let's bring in Gina. Gina, welcome to On Point.
Hi. My wife and I are hoping that John will follow Al Franken's lead and run for public office.
Ah, so there's a plan for his future. Has he given any indication whatsoever, any of our guests, that he's interested in going into politics? I find it hard to imagine.
Well, he had Bruce Springsteen play Born to Run as the very last thing and in very last episode, so maybe that's something.
It could be. It could be. Before we go out, I want to play off one more clip, and this is from the last time Jon Stewart finished up a television show. It was 20 years ago, 1995. He had had the Jon Stewart Show on MTV, and what happened was that time they canceled him, and this was his farewell then.
I'm very excited to be here. Thank you all for joining us on our final program. I just have one thing to say. Wow, I feel like I'm back at home. They're booing. I do have one quick thing to say. I've got something to say to all those people who said that my show would never make it. Good call. Wow, how did you know that? That's amazing. Why didn't you tell me?
So how different it is this time. I want to thank all of our guests, Renee Graham, music and pop culture critic and op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe. Renee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
And Bob Thompson, he is director of Syracuse University's Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Communication. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Lisa Rojak, author of Angry Optimist, The Life and Times of Jon Stewart. Lisa, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.